This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief over at numberfire.com, and this is episode 118 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the Number Fire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. Brandon Cooks is on another team. As you guys know, he was traded on Tuesday night, and when that trade happened, I sent out a tweet that pretty much sums up how I feel about the whole deal. The tweet said, "The Patriots just got a higher first-round pick than they gave up last year, all while having Brandon Cooks for a year on a rookie deal. They own this league." I was shocked by the responses. Now, I expected to hear from Eagles fans after I said that the Patriots, quote, own this league. But I heard from every fan. I heard from Saints fans, from Bills fans, from Dolphins fans, from Vikings fans. Everyone had a take, and a lot of those takes made me want to throw my laptop out the window. As I've said plenty of times on this podcast, people want black and white takes on football when it's really not smart to have black and white takes in football. Most analysis lives in a gray area. I'm wrong a lot, other analysts are wrong a lot, and Joe from Connecticut is wrong a lot. And it's because measuring and analyzing the game of football is not simplistic. That's why having only extreme takes is ridiculous. But guys, I mean this with all sincerity. I don't know how you look at this trade and say that the Patriots are stupid. When you look at both the process and the result, this is one of the biggest slam dunk moves that we've seen in a long time. This is an instance where I'm taking an extreme stance because to me, it's obvious to take that extreme stance. Let me break this thing down to show you what I mean. If you recall, New England traded for Brandon Cooks last year. They gave up the 32nd and the 103rd overall selections in last year's draft, and in return they got Brandon Cooks and the 118th overall selection. So in essence, New England got Brandon Cooks for a drop of 15 picks in the mid rounds of the draft, all while surrendering the 32nd overall pick. To be honest, the trade made sense for both New England and New Orleans at the time. I even wrote an article on NumberFire about the trade titled, "The Brandon Cooks Trade is a Win-Win for New England and New Orleans." What New England got was a very good wide receiver who still had 2 years left on his rookie deal. Or I should say he had a year left, and then he had his fifth year option. So in 2017, Cooks wasn't set to make that much money, but in 2018, he'd still be a bargain. As we know, New England got to the Super Bowl and Brandon Cooks was a productive receiver for them in 2017. And he was a productive receiver while making very little money. Cooks is going to be a free agent in 2019, so after this coming season. We just saw the kind of deal that Sammy Watkins got as a free agent, and Cooks has been a more productive receiver thus far in his career. We should expect Brandon Cooks to get that kind of loot. So what did New England do? They said to themselves, "Hey, you know what? We're not going to re-sign Cooks next offseason because he's going to be too expensive for us. So let's see what we can get for him." And what did they get for him? They got the 23rd overall pick and a 6th rounder while surrendering a 4th rounder. So let's recap this and make this as simplistic as possible. The Patriots surrendered their 32nd overall pick last year while swapping mid-round picks, and they got Brandon Cooks for a year on a super cheap deal. Then they received a 23rd overall selection, so one that's 9 picks higher in the first round than the one they gave up last year, for Brandon Cooks, a player they weren't going to sign after this season was over. And yet I had hundreds of people in my mentions on Tuesday night telling me that the deal wasn't a good one, and that anything the Patriots do just gets praise automatically. You know what? They're not entirely wrong. The Patriots do get a lot of praise. But do you know why? Because they've been in the conference title game in each of the last 7 seasons. They've been to 3 of the last 4 Super Bowls, and they've been to 4 of the last 7 Super Bowls. That's why. That's why the Patriots get so much praise, because the Patriots are unbelievable. But how can you praise the Patriots' moves when they didn't even win the Super Bowl last year with Brandon Cooks? How does this make them better? That's a legitimate question that multiple people asked me on Tuesday night when I sent that aforementioned tweet. Guys, are we serious right now? A team losing the Super Bowl didn't have a successful season just because they didn't win? So I guess any move that a team makes is considered bad because they don't win a freaking Super Bowl? And not only that, did we forget that Brandon Cooks was injured during the Super Bowl? The way this makes the Patriots better is that they're being forward-thinking. They're getting something for Brandon Cooks when they know that they'd only have Brandon Cooks for one more season. And all the while, they've received more for Brandon Cooks than what they sent for Brandon Cooks. Again, in simplistic terms, the Patriots got assets for having Brandon Cooks on a rookie deal for one season. And you want to say this trade was a draw? Or that New England didn't own this entire Brandon Cooks situation? Sure, you can look in the rear view and see how they seem to botch the Jimmy Garoppolo trade. In hindsight, they should have been able to get more. But New England makes savvy moves like this Cooks one over and over and over again, and the NFL just lets it happen. And while everyone likes to say, it's Tom Brady, he covers up so much on that team, I'll point you to the fact that they were 11-5 when they had Matt Cassel as starter in 2008. And they were 3-1 when they didn't have Tom Brady in 2016. They beat a 7-win, a 10-win, and a 9-win team during that season without Tom Brady. The league is playing checkers, and the Patriots are playing chess. Still, almost 20 years later. Now with that, let's get to this week's mailbag questions. This first one says, hey JJ, thoughts on how the Brandon Cooks trade impacts both his redraft and dynasty value? Should the fact that he's now been traded twice concern dynasty owners? Thanks, Brandon. I figured I'd kick things off with a Brandon Cooks question because it's clearly the hottest topic in fantasy football right now. So last season, Cooper Kupp for the Rams saw about 18% of the Rams' targets across his 15 games played. Robert Woods was at almost 16.5% in his 12 games. And Sammy Watkins, who also played 15 contests, saw 13.51% of the team's targets. Meanwhile, Todd Gurley had a 16.8% target share, and the team's tight ends combined for about 17% of the Rams' targets. Essentially, what I'm saying here is that the Rams spread the ball around. If Bobby Woods played 16 games, he would have probably seen over 20% of the team's targets, but with Todd Gurley and Cooper Kupp there, we've got at least some competition for targets for Brandon Cooks. The thing with Cooks, though, is that he's never seen more than 20% of his team's targets because he's played in offenses that generally do spread the ball around. He also just may not be a wide receiver who's ever going to sustain a 25% target rate. So in answering this question, I think that the first thing that we need to do is find what the difference in target share might be for Cooks in New England versus Cooks in LA. With Julian Edelman returning for the Patriots and with Chris Hogan healthy, perhaps we'd see a lower target share for Cooks here in 2018. Maybe something closer to 17 or 18%. And that's definitely a feasible number for Cooks in LA. I think a lot of people will slot him into the role that Sammy Watkins had last year, which isn't wrong, but one thing to remember with Watkins is that he was traded to LA during the preseason. It was August when he got there. He wasn't involved with the offense from April onward like Cooks will be, and that can hinder the overall development in an offense for a wide receiver. So let's just say that Cooks sees 19% of LA's targets next season, while he would have seen 17 to 18% in New England. If we take the number of attempts that the Patriots and Rams had last year, that puts Brandon Cooks at 98 or 99 targets on the season, regardless of the team that he's on. If he were to be on New England or LA, he'd get around that many targets. And I think that you can make a real argument that the Rams will be a more run-heavy team in 2018, just given their defensive additions and the chance of positive game flows for that offense. Naturally, from a redraft perspective, playing with Tom Brady is going to be more beneficial than playing with Jared Goff. The Patriots are going to project to have a better offense than the Rams will, especially when we're looking at touchdown distribution. Jared Goff already has some regression coming in the passing touchdown department. Or I should say, we shouldn't expect Goff to have the same type of touchdown rate as he did last year, whereas Tom Brady is going to compete for the league lead in touchdown passes. There's that, and there's also the fact that Goff had a 7.9 average depth of target last year, while Tom Brady's was 9.1. Brady's been known as a dink and dunker, but he ranked 4th in completed air yards per attempt last season out of 35 passers with 200 or more targets. Jared Goff ranked 17th. And we know Brandon Cooks is a deep threat. Goff actually threw at 15 or more air yards on 17.82% of his attempts, while Tom Brady's deep ball rate was 20.48%. And remember, that's on more attempts as well. So as a result, I'd expect Cook's per target effectiveness to dip with the move to LA. And with a projected similar number of targets, that's an overall downgrade for Brandon Cooks. Now, if you're talking dynasty, I think that you can make the argument that things shouldn't change all that dramatically. I do think the scary part with Cooks right now, though, is that he's a free agent next year. While I fully expect the team to get a deal done with him before he becomes a free agent, you just never know. And right now, Cooks isn't in that bad of a spot for his long-term outlook. But overall, I would probably just keep Cooks where I had him before. Maybe a slight downgrade since I played Dynasty with more of a redraft perspective. But I wouldn't go overboard with pushing Cooks up or down my rankings. And for what it's worth, guys, I'm not that concerned with this being his third team. If there was any fear, a team wouldn't have just spent the 23rd overall pick for a dude on the last year of his contract. This next one says, hey JJ, love the podcast and your rants. I always look forward to the air horn intro to start my day. Thanks. I was taking your advice and combing through my draft last year to see what I did wrong and right. My process seemed okay, but I'm afraid I took too many risky players. I grabbed a guy like Crowell because I assumed his volume would increase and snagged Doug Martin late because I thought he would be forgotten about. I had some bad luck with David Johnson getting hurt early on, but flopped big on guys like Parker, Martin, and Crowell. How do you decide how much risk to take in a redraft league? The upside of some of these players is tantalizing, but when does safety take precedence? Appreciate your time, Tim. To be honest, guys, I take the approach most of the time where my early rounds are for safety and my late rounds are for degaffing. But I also think that it's important to focus on team offenses as well in order to minimize those risks. Going into last year, we knew Cleveland's offense was questionable. We knew the Dolphins' offense was questionable. If we're gobbling up players in bad offenses, the chances of them panning out is then lowered. That's just how it works. A player getting 200 carries in a bad offense is not necessarily better than a player getting 150 carries in an elite one. And generally speaking, in the early rounds, there are basically two ways that a player is risky. He's either in a bad offense, like I just said, or we don't have a strong enough sample size on him, or we don't have a large enough sample on him performing at a high level, like the case with Devontae Parker. So I think in your case, Tim, it was an overall approach. If you got Doug Martin late, that's fine. I can't fault people's late round draft picks. But if you got Crowell and Parker, you fell into the trap of not weighing offensive situation enough, combined with a lack of overall sample on those players. This next one's from Twitter from @Mercom. It says, explain to me how the term regression when applied to projected fantasy performance is not gambler's fallacy. Last year, I heard experts say Julio Jones was on the positive side of touchdown regression and was due for more scores, which never came. Okay, so I've answered this question in a previous mailbag episode, but I also think that it's a very important topic for fantasy analysis and the consumption of fantasy analysis. This is straight from Wikipedia, but for those unfamiliar, the gambler's fallacy is the mistaken belief that if something happens more frequently than normal during a given period, it will happen less frequently in the future. The opposite then is true too. Let's say that Julio Jones has one touchdown throughout his first 10 games when he should have four based on his receiving yardage totals. So in an article, you see an analyst write that Julio Jones is going to see some positive regression in the touchdown department. This does not mean that those three touchdowns will be kind of made up for as the season progresses. It means that he's underperforming in the touchdown department, and moving forward, we should simply expect him to perform at a more normal rate. And that rate can come in the form of what's normal across the NFL, or if we have a good sample, it can be the rate that he normally scores touchdowns at. The gambler's fallacy would tell us that we should expect him to perform at an increased rate to make up for what he didn't do over those first 10 games. But that's not what regression analysis is helping us find. Instead, we're looking at the average and seeing how far off a player is from that average. And then, moving forward, we should expect the player to perform at that average. If someone is selling this as something else, then you should question their methods. Because if Julio Jones has an expected touchdown total of 8 in a given season, and he has 1 through the first 10 games, that doesn't mean we should expect 7 touchdowns over his final 6 games. It means that over his final 6 games, we should expect something closer to the average rather than the 1 touchdown per 10 games rate that he's moving at. So hopefully that makes sense. This next one's from Patrick. It says, hey, I have a question. Well, Patrick, hopefully I have an answer. I'm in a dynasty league that is a 12-team superflex. We also start 3 running backs, 3 wide receivers, 1 tight end, and 2 flex besides the superflex, meaning we start 36 running backs, 36 wide receivers, and then another 24 running back, wide receiver, tight end in those flex spots, along with the approximate 24 quarterbacks. From a supply and demand perspective, the demand for all positions besides tight end goes up compared to a standard league, which should mean that, apart from devaluing tight ends, I should probably value players closer to a 1 quarterback league than a 2 quarterback league. Am I correct in this thinking? However, my league mates are all quarterback crazy and the position's value is through the roof. Should the demand within my league then override the actual demands of the format? I'm starting to feel like I'm never going to be able to acquire a quarterback unless I'm willing to pay a premium or pick up long shot waiver wire ads because all the high upside backups are rostered. For example, someone offered me AJ McCarron for the 2.03 pick in the rookie draft. This seems like an overpay for someone who I don't think will be starting at the end of the season. If it matters, I have Stafford, Newton, and Kaiser on my roster right now. Okay, so first off, yes, you're totally right with your evaluation of the league. I did a podcast last year on the supply and demand aspect of fantasy football and referenced a league that's very similar to this one. Everyone values quarterbacks highly, but realistically, the demand of the position isn't that dramatically different than a normal league because you're starting so many more running backs and wide receivers. So good on you for recognizing this. I loved reading this email because you did recognize that. To answer your question about the way your league values quarterbacks, you most definitely have to pay more than you'd like as you adjust for your league's tendencies. But you should also still be able to win games because you're boosting in areas of your roster that are just as or more important while everyone is too focused on quarterbacks. And to be honest, man, if you have Stafford and Newton on your roster right now, I wouldn't care much about how your league is valuing quarterbacks. Those are two dudes who should be starters for a good chunk of time. And during a bye week, just play a non-quarterback in the flex if need be. And if they get hurt, then you can adjust and trade for a quarterback depending on how strong your team is performing in that given season. All the while, you can make cheap dart throws in your rookie draft at the position or find guys off the waiver wire who are filling in for their starters. This next one is an email that says, "Hi JJ, love your analytical and passionate insight into the game that we love. Thanks. I'm about to embark on starting my first Dynasty League, and while I have many questions I could ask, the one that is giving me the most trouble is about how to handle FOB. I've never been in a league that does FOB, and I've wanted to try it for a while, so I'm using this opportunity to do so. How do you suggest going about it for a year-round dynasty league? How have you seen it most successfully implemented in this format? Any help would be greatly appreciated. Andrew." Free agent auction budget spending will vary depending on your league, especially if owners are inexperienced with it. But I'm going to keep this pretty simple. The one piece of advice with a dynasty league is to not be afraid to spend, especially at running back and wide receiver. Since rosters are larger, that means there's a smaller pool of viable players in free agency. And if that's the case, then good players won't come up very often. And when they do, you have to spend in order to get them. That's the number one thing to remember. This next one's an email that says, "Hi JJ, longtime listener and I love the show. Thanks. I have a question regarding a trade offer that I'm thinking of making. In a dynasty league, I'm considering trading Le'Veon Bell for Saquon Barkley, unless you think I could possibly squeeze a bit more out of the owner. Firstly, is this a good trade offer? And secondly, if it's a good offer, should I wait to find out where Saquon Barkley is going before I make the offer? Robert." As I mentioned a lot on this podcast, I look at dynasty roster construction and management with a much shorter time frame than most. I think it's incredibly tough to predict what's going to happen 2 or 3 or 4 years from now in the NFL. And it's not like a short-term view means that I can't still plan for the long term. And as a result of this, I would never ever give up Le'Veon Bell, arguably the best player in fantasy football this season and over the last few years, for a player who's yet to play a snap in the NFL. Because here's the thing. I understand the argument that Bell may not be a Steeler after this season. There's ambiguity with his team situation, and he's also 26 years old. But you also don't know what team Saquon Barkley is going to go to, and the chance that he lands on a team that would provide the same type of opportunity that Pittsburgh is providing for Le'Veon Bell is pretty slim. And not only that, guys, we don't know if Saquon Barkley is going to be good. Now look, we have a pretty good idea, and like I said before, once his draft slot is inputted into my model, he'll probably be the number one ranked prospect my model has ever seen, and that dates back to 2005. But no player is a guarantee. No player is a lock to perform well in the NFL. And no player is definitely a lock to perform as well as arguably the best running back in the NFL right now. So no, I wouldn't be making that swap for a lot of reasons. Of course, in the range of outcomes here is Saquon Barkley being a better dynasty asset than Le'Veon Bell. But there's more risk than reward here, in my opinion. This last one is from @JustinFreeman18 on Twitter. He says, "Last year, you noted that Alvin Kamara's ideal landing spot would be New Orleans. He happened to end up there and was obviously productive. Are there any prospects in this year's draft that make you say he really needs to go to a team like X or Y, either based on need or scheme?" I think a question like this is easiest at the running back position because we see more immediate impact there than at wide receiver. But I also don't think that we have as natural or obvious as a fit as we saw last year with New Orleans and Alvin Kamara. You had the combination of an electric pass-catching back going to the most friendly place for a receiving running back. But I'll talk about one of my favorite mid-round backs here, and that's John Kelly. And I think a landing spot that would be really interesting for John Kelly is in Seattle. I know the Seahawks have plenty of issues on the offensive line. There also aren't many situations across the league for running backs to make an immediate impact with great offensive line play, though. Very rarely will you find the ideal situation like we did with Alvin Kamara last year. If you recall, I mentioned that I saw a little Kareem Hunt to John Kelly's game a month or so ago when I did a podcast on running back prospects. And then, at John Kelly's pro day, he ran a pretty slow 40. But funny enough, on playerprofiler.com, Kelly's top comparable is now Kareem Hunt. You gotta love when things work out like that. There are concerns about that 40 time though. But let's look at John Kelly as a back versus what's going on in Seattle. Kelly has a really impressive receiving profile. He actually caught a higher percentage of his team's passes last year than Saquon Barkley did for his. And 2 years ago, John Kelly had a higher yards per carry average than Alvin Kamara did at Tennessee. They were in the same backfield. Right now in Seattle, you've got a pretty wide open depth chart where the biggest running back competition is probably Chris Carson, but literally everyone on that depth chart has either underwhelmed or not proven over a long period of time to be effective backs in the NFL. And there aren't proven pass catchers in that offense right now aside from Doug Baldwin. So that could open up volume through the air for someone like John Kelly. The problem is that Seattle doesn't pick until round four after round one, and Kelly could hypothetically be gone by then. But I do think that he'd be the right kind of back for them, and he could make an immediate impact if he lands there. They're not necessarily the best spot for a running back, but I do think that they're a good spot for his particular skill set for him to see immediate volume and be productive. That's the last question for today's show, though. Thanks to everyone for listening. If you've yet to subscribe to the Late Round Podcast, do so by going to Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Google Play, and Stitcher. Enjoy your weekends, guys. I'll talk to you next week.